Hello and welcome to the program. My name is Luke Hunt and this is another podcast for The Diplomat. And we're coming to you from Bali, a lovely setting where I've been attending the Law Aid International Conference with Craig Tuck. Craig is a barrister from New Zealand who has worked extensively from around the region. And we're going to be talking about the concept of dignity and how that is framed in international human rights and law. Craig, welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
The conference was a terrific success. The whole concept of dignity within the framework of law and international law. Can you explain that a little bit to the listeners and viewers about how this works? Because it's it seems to be where the law is going next.
Yeah, it's fascinating because the concept of human dignity as it sort of manifests in law is a relatively recent event, so 1948. But prior to that, of course, across religions, across cultures, mm-hmm. historically, and across different jurisdictions, there's manifestations, if you like, of that concept. And a lot of it could be understood in terms of the soul and the breath and that thing that we've got within us when we're on the ride of life. So it's that inherent worth, if you like. It's that thing that we carry within us. So it wasn't really until the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948 that the international legal instruments started to describe that bundle of rights and responsibilities. From there, it makes its way into domestic jurisdictions. So it's a fascinating concept, and it's always captivated me in the sense that it's that core thing within us that we all have, that we all, for that short time that we live from our first breath to our last breath, that's that thing that's with us. And if law is about anything, it really should be about protecting and honoring that thing.
Mm-hmm.
And look, there's lots of different descriptions of it. And some people would say it's meaningless because it can't be specifically described. But from my perspective, people understand immediately what you're talking about when you're talking about the dignity, the autonomy, you know, the importance of privacy in our life, to think our thoughts, to, you know, create that world that we want for ourselves and for our children and in the communities that we live. So, you know, it's that almost mystical concept in a sense, but more and more it's coming to us through legal frameworks.
Right.
You know, so sort of top end global instruments, but now working its way into domestic, and it has been for some years, working its way into domestic law. I am particularly interested in the criminal justice system, and having worked in it for nearly 40 years, and it's where that concept, where the rubber hits the road with that concept in terms of process, you know, in terms of how the police are dealing with people, how the courts deal with people, how the jails deal with people, and really saying, well, this should be front and center, you know, that it's a lens that we can use in our interactions with people. But in something like a criminal justice system where, you know, the ultimate state power is exercised, that should be absolutely central to the decision making and the procedural process.
Right. And where are you seeing this express itself, I guess, within the law? Because one would imagine this is absolutely relevant to Indigenous communities, New Zealand, Australia, Canada, around the planet, but also the three big wars going on at the moment, Ukraine, Gaza, and Myanmar.
Yep.
And there's no shortage of human rights abuses in Southeast Asia where we are now. We've just had the Indonesian riots,
yep.
and there are 23 people missing. How is this going to extend in the law over the coming years?
Yeah, so
through precedent or?
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously in the common law world that things work that way. But let's just look specifically at the way that we approach those sorts of disputes. And if we look, and there are lots of different ways of defining that in law. I mean, there's rank, there's all sorts of different approaches. But if we look at that initial sacred, if you like, the philosophy of mm-hmm. what it means to be a person, what it means to be a citizen, and how state power, whether it be in war regimes or in the dealings with people on a day-to-day basis, there needs to be, and I think the important question is, where is this going, not where is it now?
Right.
There needs to be an understanding that the individual ultimately takes responsibility for their life,
mm-hmm.
and inherent in that individual decision-making process is their own dignity, but also the way that they deal with others in that context. So if you're just sweeping away rights and responsibilities, which, you know, it's that exercise of arbitrary power, one person making an arbitrary decision on another and leading to conflict,
right.
That it really sidesteps fundamental respectful responsibilities in that paradigm.
Okay, I remember at the conference where you mentioned a term, I think it was like the theft of autonomy,
yeah.
The taking away of not just human rights, but, you know, whether it's a prosecutor, the police, corporations, politicians, but it's... Yeah. We're going to take away your autonomy.
That's right.
Which I think is quite a powerful way of putting it.
Yeah.
Do you see much of that? I mean, and you are dealing with, you're in Hotel Cake, Kirkaborian prison yesterday, dealing with clients. How do you kind of relate this? Because I do think you're more than a few steps ahead of the game in terms of defense advocacy, and I guess with people who are being prosecuted.
So Kirabakan's a fascinating jail to work in, and I've seen that evolve over the last 10 or 15 years. But I guess from a personal approach, it's always about bringing respect to the situation, bringing respect to the office that people have a job to do. But within that job, there is, you know, that sacred passage of the human condition,
right?
The journey, the on the ride, if you like. And in dealing in situations like that, especially with clients that are vulnerable and being overwhelmed with their autonomy being taken, and the state obviously through legislation can do that. But it's bringing the dignity to a situation, to a role, to a it's an environment there, but in any criminal justice system, where somebody feels that they have a sense of fair trial, that is, that they've got a say, that they understand the proceedings, and you know, the fair trial rights are so inherent to human dignity. It's like, you know, you can't be exercising arbitrary power, decision making over others, and just saying, you know, if you can deal with it. That's not a system that we want. You know, we don't want the law of the jungle. We understand that there needs to be structures and procedures, but almost drenched within that is this concept of respect, understanding that they're autonomous within that framework because they, you know, they have informed consent, essentially, that they get the resources they need most criminal justice systems are utterly brutal in terms of, you know, the meat grinder. It just grinds on regardless. And it's the ultimate expression of force. Government, you know, that is the ultimate expression of force. It's that monopolization of violence where, just as an example, you don't pay your parking ticket, you know, maybe $12. You then get community work eventually because, you know, your fines have got so big and your penalties, and then you don't do community work and you end up in jail because you don't do your community work. So the process ultimately in a criminal justice system is the monopolization of violence, and you do not want arbitrary power being expressed through that. You want a process that brings dignity, empowerment. I hate that word empowerment, but autonomy.
It's very NGO.
Oh, it's a shocker. But it's acknowledging, you know, that there is a cluster of rights and responsibilities that attach with the human condition.
Well, this is what I'm trying to get at. I think I always remember working in, better not mention the country, but I was talking to a police chief, extremely high up in that nation's criminal framework. And we were talking about, you know, human rights and that people have human rights. And he just bluntly said, you know, people have human rights, but it's my job to take them away.
Hey.
And it's like, well, no, not really. But I wasn't about to argue with him because you never know what's going to happen down the road. And it's just sort of a lot of the judicial system seem to be run more on fear and deliberately so.
Yeah, I mean,
and particularly in Southeast Asia.
Sure. And I guess there's a lot of ways, you know, the philosophy that attaches to, for instance, sentencing practices, mm-hmm. you know, retribution or retaliation or those sorts of things. So criminal justice systems are designed to bring to bear a whole bunch of criminological, philosophical realities.
Okay.
And I guess what I'm always looking at is, no matter what's at play, how is the dignity, you know, essentially the soul, if you like, of the person being protected and guarded and acknowledged. Now, there's always a balancing that most judges would say, look, there's always a balancing of an individual's rights against, you know, the state and protection and the rights of the community. Having said that, though, there is a whole there's an approach that still brings dignity to the individual, to the defendant, to the complainants, to the victims, where respect is given in a process, and I think probably adds weight when somebody feels they're involved in the process and has a voice in it, then that's a much more powerful process when people are adopting that and understand it. And
right. Yeah. There was an impressive list of speakers at this conference, academics in the United States, in New Zealand, Australia, in lawyers in London, and they're all talking about this concept of dignity. And how do we get it into the legal framework? I mean, as I understand it, you've been offered complete a PhD at Cambridge in incorporating dignity into the law. I mean, obviously the trick here is, how do you actually define it and do it? But it is being written about at the highest intellectual levels where UN policies are written, government policies are written. So it's not just pie in the sky, it is actually going forward.
Yeah, well, I think as Noam Chomsky would say, it's 100% acknowledged and 100% ignored at many levels, you know.
Right.
But what I find really fascinating is reading about different religions, reading about different cultures and their value system, and then looking at all the different jurisdictions, all the nation states, how they talk about that concept and how they integrate it not only into the statutes or codes, but also how the judge is talking about it, and, you know, what is alive to the judiciary in terms of search warrants, you know, invasions of privacy. And I could go on, but, you know, it's fascinating to see now that the acknowledgement or reflection on the human condition, that brief life that we have, and how law needs to make sense and align with that concept of dignity and soul, essentially.
I'm kind of curious as to how much of this has come out of New Zealand in that the New Zealand experience through the Treaty of Waitangi, you have a very much a different relationship with the Maori population as opposed to in Australia and the indigenous population there with the Aboriginals, which are completely different experiences. I'm not, I don't want to get into an argument over who did the right thing and who didn't or how it's worked, how it worked. But my impression is that the New Zealand experience combined Maori law as in L-O-R-E as much as L-A-W with Western concepts and then pulled it together. Is that, does that help in terms of building a legal framework for these sorts of concepts?
So what I can do is just talk personally about that. Sure. I don't want to kind of cross over into, there's lots written and obviously there's different cultural perspectives on that. For me personally, as a Pākehā, as a European, educated in England and in New Zealand and working in a number of different jurisdictions, the insight of the partnership agreement, so the, it's a partnership where concepts like mana and, respect for the different cultures and acknowledging and integrating that lawmaking practice and decision making.
Right.
So there's very much a consultation model there. It's meant to be. That has its problems. But there definitely is that idea of a partnership that we must consult, that we must acknowledge and move forward in a way that retains the what we would say is the mana, the respect, the dignity of the cultures. So it is front and center there from my perspective, certainly as a lawyer in New Zealand, which is quite a different experience in Australia, where I live a lot as well. And the attitude is different. It's the attitude in the penal system in Australia is different, certainly in the Northern Territory, for instance, where the jails don't seem to connect at all.
And it's just these constant reports about Aboriginal deaths in custodies, kids who are being locked up, or Aboriginal kids who are being locked up at a very young age, and the suicide rate is horrific.
Well, the imprisonment rate is a starter, and if you just look at the numbers there, you know, it certainly raises some questions.
Yep.
Which kind of leads into what should a prison look like? We're taking somebody's freedom. That's an accepted proposition because, you know, obviously some offending is safety is required. But what about the jail environment? You know, this high idea of locking people away for 23 hours, people, you know, that are, you know, have all manner of mental health issues. And you know, where is that going as opposed to a more community oriented? What do the facilities look like? And people would say, well, it should be on the minimum cost, but you need to take a much more holistic approach if you're taking human dignity as its focus, for instance, and saying, well, if you're going to treat people in this way, what are we going to get at the end of that when they're back out on the street inevitably?
Yep.
And how does that play out? So looking at a much more holistic cost model,
right?
Emotional cost, not just financial. But,
and the one word we haven't mentioned so far is rehabilitation. And where I come from and the way we were raised, and I think the key word were people who went to prison, the idea was to rehabilitate them and bring them back into society. But it seems to have been lost somewhere along the way, particularly when we look at examples like in the Northern Territory, and not just there, elsewhere, right across Southeast Asia. Well,
across the world, actually.
Yeah.
Incarceration and vast incarceration in the US and say the Northern Territory and other jurisdictions, I think we need to really look long and hard at that. For instance, even just starting with a bail proposition in New Zealand, we have a very high remand population. That is people that can't get bail because they can't get a house. So, you know, they're now at the taxpayer's expense. They're cut off from the ability to work, from their family, their communication with the lawyers, their, you know, the whole disconnection can start right at that very first hearing at court where, you know, providing a suitable address can't do that. We don't have enough houses. So if you're poor, you're getting locked up. Right. And that just starts the ball rolling, and there's a whole sequence of events that follows through into, say, a sentenced population where in jails, if, for instance, you've got 10 or 20 people in a cell and some are having to sleep, and some don't even have the yoga mat to sleep on, they're having to sleep around a toilet on a cold floor. Fact. And that they don't have support from the outside, therefore they can't get the food they need. And the lights in most jails are on all night. So people are sleeping with the light on.
They don't know what time it is.
Don't know what time it is. The body clock's out. And I'm sure that some of your listeners will be saying, hey, tough. But many are remand prisoners waiting to have a trial that are in conditions sleeping on a floor. They're not sleeping properly. They're not eating properly. They can't think properly after a while.
Yeah.
And their access to information and proper decision-making is impaired. But at the end of the day, people are going to get released, and we're looking, it's always a risk profile from a government perspective. It's risk and it's cost, fiscal spend. So there's a real argument for dignity in that, because if you're bringing a sense of responsibility, of autonomy, of engagement in the system, they are engaged, they're owning it, then you're going to have a much better outcome.
Now, I remember James Ricketson, who was a very well-known Australian filmmaker who was charged with spying in Cambodia, and he was given a pretty rough time. He was in remand in Prey Sar prison, where I think they had, in reality, 1 square meter each.
Yeah.
Cracked food, no light. Next to other prisoners who have lice, can't get a shower.
No.
And for him, the great victory came when he was found guilty, because he could go into a prison hospital.
Yeah.
He could go into a regular prison cell, and from there he went into a prison hospital.
Yeah.
And once you're in the prison compound, you could buy your own food.
Yeah.
There are lots of ways. I guess it was the same with Hotel K. The remand system is, and then you have all these young offenders who are placed in with the older offenders, and that's where they get schooled.
Yep, and you're in with a bunch of gang activity and all manner of things.
Yep.
I've always thought, though, there's lots of problems within criminal justice, but if you looked at just that initial remand process and that there was available or suitable bail houses, which, is a planet problem, then you are saving huge amounts of money. You're providing, you're not having that two-tier criminal justice system where the poor are locked up and those wealthy enough to have a house or a room or a couch are treated differently.
This is what you were saying before about houses, in that you can't get bail if you haven't got collateral to put up.
Well, starting point's a residential address for everybody globally.
Okay, yeah.
And if you don't have a suitable residential address, whatever that is, then you are in custody.
Right, you're not getting bail.
You're in custody and you're getting your phone call. You're in a very tight, mostly very tight living experience.
Yep.
And that's, your dignity implodes at that point when your resources.
How do you find dealing with governments, left wing, right wing, Asian, autocrats?
Yeah.
And the way the world's going at the moment, it's a hell of a mix out there.
Yeah. So there are always protocols, and some of those protocols are very, very slow, and you're not to breach them. We had an incident yesterday, for instance, where I had to just turn up at a jail without a scheduled appointment, without my letter, because it was on the wrong day.
Right.
And making it work by explaining, hey, this is our role. This is what we're here to do.
Yep.
We're trying to ensure this process runs smoothly, as opposed to, in a chronology of events that somebody's sitting in a head office, wherever it is around the world, agrees with. We're just trying to make this work on the ground. and just boxing on, respecting your position. You've got a job to do, but so have I. How are we going to make this work?
And sometimes it does. Craig Tuck, thanks very much for the chat. It's been terrific.
Right.
And good luck with the whole concept of dignity. I think it matters.
I certainly. Thanks for the opportunity.
Cheers.
Right. How did that come across?
It was good.
All right.
Stop.